Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session.
Good morning. You may be seated. The first case on our calendar is 07-219 and 415, Linda Akison, Administratrix versus Anchor Packing Company. Mr. Schuster, the attorneys can come up and sit at the council table. All of you should be up at the council tables, please. Mr. Schuster.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, my name is Rick Schuster. I'm here arguing on behalf of appellants. With me at council table is Robert Riley. We will be reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. Excuse me. And Mr. Riley and I will be splitting the rebuttal time. He'll take 3 minutes and I'll take two.
You're going to need to watch your time on the clock closely to do all that.
This case presents the question of whether the prima facie procedures found in 2307.92 and 2307.93 of the revised code may be constitutionally applied to cases pending on the effective date of House Bill 292, which was September 2, 2004. The Fourth District Court of Appeals held that these procedures could not be applied to pending cases. This court's review of that decision is de novo. The statute, House Bill 292, and these procedures enjoy a strong presumption of constitutionality. This court has followed a two-step analysis in cases challenging the retroactive application of a statute. First, the court determines whether the General Assembly intended for the statute to be applied retroactively. That is not an issue in this case. Everyone agrees that was the intent of the General Assembly. The second step for this court is to determine whether the statute is remedial rather than substantive. Appellants believe that this court answered the second question in the Boggle case, which was decided several weeks ago, where the court stated at paragraph 17 of its decision, the provisions of the statute do not relate to the rights and duties that give rise to this cause of action or otherwise make it more difficult for a claimant to succeed on the merits of a claim. Rather, they pertain to the machinery for carrying on a suit. They are therefore procedural in nature, not substantive.
That wouldn't be true as it applies to Linda Atkinson, though, would it?
Yes, I believe it would be true, Your Honor, that these are procedural.
No, that it doesn't make it more difficult.
I do not believe.
That part of the paragraph, this court wasn't thinking about this type of case when that paragraph was written, I don't think.
In the Boggle case, I believe that the court had before it four individuals who had brought lawsuits and who were not unable to show that they had any type of asbestos-related injury. The question before
Were any of them deceased?
One of the individuals in Boggle was deceased because there was a representative of the estate who was the party at issue there. I believe, Your Honor, if your question means that does Ms. Akison, as the executrix of the estate, have a responsibility to bring forward certain information to show that she has a valid claim, the answer would be yes. But that's true under our laws that exist today. It's true under Civil Rule 11. Before you file your claim, you must have a reasonable basis for filing the claim. And this procedure, this prima facie procedure, does nothing more than require that information.
Well, how do you comply with the requirement that the treating physician step up on this?
Well, Your Honor, the prima facie case procedure does require that competent medical authority show the link between the asbestos exposure and the disease.
That has
been a part of our law since 1980.
But doesn't it have a requirement that the treating physician be involved in that?
Yes, competent medical authority has been defined, it's been clarified to mean someone who treated an individual and has been board certified in a wide range of specialties that would relate to asbestos diseases. That was information that was presented to the General Assembly, actually by the head of pulmonology at the Ohio State University, Dr. Allen, who testified that the criteria that were being considered here were at the very minimum of what he would require to diagnose the disease asbestosis. He indicated he actually would require more, but that these minimum criteria would at least give you a factual basis for saying that someone has this type of a disease, asbestosis, which is pulmonary fibrosis of the lung caused by your asbestos exposure. And Dr. Allen testified before the legislature, and that is part of the findings in the uncodified portion of the bill.
So if you change the law to require that this competent physician also be the treating physician, and if you die of this disease, but your physician that was treating you doesn't qualify to give the expert opinion, what do you do?
Well, to go back, I don't think we were changing I don't think that the legislature was changing the law. The legislature was clarifying a term in the law that had never been addressed by this court and had not been defined by the legislature. This court has recognized the right of the General Assembly to go in and clarify a law, and there are several cases that we've cited in our brief on this issue of clarification. This court has recognized that you can go in and you can clarify a term that's in a statute as long as the Supreme Court of Ohio hasn't already done that, hasn't already addressed that issue and clarified the term.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals talk about that very thing, clarifying in the Van Fossen case?
The Court of Appeals here, the Fourth District Court of Appeals, seemed to indicate that they felt that there was some common understanding of what the term competent medical authority meant. But that there isn't any common understanding of that. There was no case law cited by the Court of Appeals to support that. There was no case law cited by the appellees to indicate that any court in Ohio had looked at this issue and had given definition to that term. In fact, this court and the United States Supreme Court have both recognized that there is no vested right in the common law, and there's no vested right in some ambiguous term that exists out there. Instead, it's at the prerogative of this court as the highest court in the state to define a term, or the General Assembly, which is the other body that can declare the law for the entire state.
Well, I want to come back to, I guess what's troubling me is, if you die of this disease and you were seeing a doctor, your family physician, until you died, who wasn't really qualified to recognize or give, you know, you don't discover until there's a postmortem that that's really what killed you. What do you do in terms of getting your case into court?
Well, Your Honor, what I would do if I was plaintiff's counsel is I would go to the physician that was treating the individual who is now deceased and talk to that doctor and have them write a letter or do an affidavit. You could take a deposition of that doctor if you wanted, and you would have that information to move forward. If someone came to my office and said, you know, I have someone, a relative who died, and I want you to file a case, I would have to do a good faith review of the file and look into it and determine that, in fact, this person had the disease. And since 1980, it's been required that competent medical authority diagnose an asbestos-related disease before that cause of action can accrue. In this case, the appellee offered no evidence to the trial court that anyone had diagnosed Mr. Akison with asbestosis. That was not provided to the trial court, and the trial court correctly found that there was no prima facie evidence of asbestosis and administratively dismissed the case.
So your view is this case was out under the old law?
My view is, yes, that under the old law, there had been no accrual of a cause of action. There was presented to the trial court a one-page form that was a B-read, which is an X-ray reading, that doesn't mention the word asbestosis in it. There was no indication this person had an asbestos-related disease. And that's the issue that's been certified to this court, whether this non-malignant claim and the prima facie criteria here can be applied to that non-malignant claim. And there was just no evidence before the trial court that would substantiate a claim that this Mr. Akison had asbestosis. They could have brought in his treating physicians, but they chose not to. The prima facie case simply moves up in time when a case is going to be reviewed, because the fact is that there are literally almost 40,000 cases that were pending on September 2nd, 2004, and our courts have not been able to deal with those cases. The legislature has put forward a procedure that enables the courts to deal with those cases.
Well, the three judges have dealt with them, but the cases keep coming, so it's hard for them to keep up. The 40,000 stays constant, but it's inflow and outflow. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, you are correct. The three judges who have been appointed up in Cuyahoga County, Judge Hanna, Judge Spellacy, and former Justice Sweeney, have done a wonderful job of working very hard to maintain that docket. But Judge Spellacy testified before the legislature, and he said that the judges would never be able to deal with the cases that were pending there. There are cases pending since 1995 that have not been dealt with by the court.
Let me ask you, Mr. Schuster, your mention of the prima facie requirement simply moves up the final decision, I guess we would say. In your opinion, can someone receive a judgment in their favor in a case such as this if they've not shown a prima facie case?
Well, Your Honor, the answer would be no. If they failed to show the prima facie case and never came back with prima facie material, then that case would be administratively dismissed until they come forward with it. So it would not move on to trial until they come forward with evidence that shows they had a valid cause of action.
I misled you. I think generally, could a party win their case if they've not been able to show at the beginning of the case a prima facie case? Is that?
No. Those types of cases would be dismissed either on a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment. They would never make it to the trial stage. But there are cases where individual cases have been administratively dismissed under the statute, and then they have been reinstated. We just had a case this week where former Justice Sweeney reinstated a silicosis case that he had administratively dismissed because the plaintiffs had failed to come forward with proof. After a period of time, they gathered their proof, they came forward, and to the satisfaction of Justice Sweeney, showed that they had met the prima facie case, and he reinstated the case. It's not a difficult procedure to go forward with, and as this court has noted, it's nothing more than has been required by Civil Rule 11 for many years. At this point, Your Honor, I think I've gone over the time I was allotting for this, and I will take my seat and wait for rebuttal.
Mr. Riley, do you wish to argue now, or you have about three minutes? All right. Mr. Green.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Vincent Green, and with my co-counsel, Richard Reverman, I have the honor of representing Linda Akison and the late Danny Akison. Allow me to be as clear as possible, Your Honors. But for a ruling of this court that as applied to Mr. Akison's non-malignant claim, House Bill 292 is unconstitutional, that claim is over. It can never be reactivated. This is not a situation, in contrast to the Bogle case, where there has been merely a prioritization of Mr. Akison's claim, and should his disease progress, he can come back. Because Mr. Akison's non-malignant disease process developed prior to the passage of this act, and because he filed his lawsuit prior to the passage of this act, and because he passed away prior to the effective date of this act, his disease did not progress to the point required by this act. He did not obtain a necessary treating physician as required by this act, and he can never return to court on that non-malignant claim.
Let me ask you the same question I put to Mr. Schuster. Do you believe that somebody who cannot prove a prima facie case can win at the end of the trial or the case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if I may, just to clarify a question, I think what you're saying to me is, can someone who cannot meet the threshold set forth by House Bill 292, nonetheless, as the law existed prior to House Bill 292, would that person have been able to succeed, withstand a summary judgment motion, and succeed at trial? Absolutely. The state of the law in Ohio prior to House Bill 292 was that any material change to the lungs caused by asbestos constituted a viable and compensable injury. That is the originating claim for Mr. Atkinson. And I want to be clear, Your Honors, Mr. Atkinson did not have what's known as asbestosis. Asbestosis is a fibrotic disease of the parenchyma of the lung. Mr. Atkinson was diagnosed with asbestos-related pleural thickening, and that was the original basis for his lawsuit.
Well, let me so that you don't waste your time. My question really is not the requirement that someone show a prima facie case, isn't that unlocking the door to the court? And if one cannot do that, we say you can't come into court. Now your argument, which seems to me to be procedural, that we're moving up the judgment date from the time when one would receive a judgment at the end of a trial to the beginning of the trial or the proceedings, and saying if you can't show a prima facie case, you know, we're not going to take our time to decide whether you win because you haven't met the very minimum standard. And what's your response to that? Is that same response?
Well, there's two responses to that, Your Honor. The first one is that by closing the courthouse door, Mr. Atkinson's rights have been violated. In our brief, we discussed towards the end of our brief the effect of this on the right to access to the court. But more importantly, Your Honor, I believe what the difference here is, the prima facie case requirement that my brother said moves up the time frame. In this situation, that requirement sets a higher bar than the evidence that Mr. Atkinson would be required to put forth at trial. And the reason I was distinguishing between his pleural thickening non-malignant claim and asbestosis is part of the requirement of this bill is that an individual alleging a non-malignant claim have a class 2 impairment according to the AMA guidelines. That's a very severe breathing inhibition as a result to asbestosis. That is what Mr. Atkinson would have to have established. And so, Your Honor, while you've moved up the time frame to put forth evidence, the other thing that this statute does is demand a higher level of evidence than was otherwise demanded under Ohio law.
But that requirement goes to the prospective cases as well, does it not? That's not a retrospective issue, is it?
It is a retrospective issue. That criteria for impairment and that criteria for who is a competent medical authority applies both retroactively and prospectively. And I believe, Your Honor, when you refer to it as procedural, or we can use the term remedial, I believe that if you look at the case law cited in our brief, you find that is irrelevant because even if it is remedial or procedural, if it has the effect of destroying a vested right, then it is violative of Section 28 of Article 2 of the Ohio Constitution. If it were not, that provision of the Constitution would have no teeth whatsoever. The legislature could call anything it wanted procedural.
Who made this diagnosis?
Who made the diagnosis?
Yes.
Dr. Altmaier.
And who is Dr. Altmaier?
Dr. Altmaier is a individual who is a competent medical authority under the law as it existed prior to House Bill 292.
Is he board certified?
He is a board certified doctor.
In what area?
In pulmonology.
And is he from the same state as Ohio?
He is not from Ohio.
So how did this gentleman who is ill, according to you, get to this doctor?
It was requested that he review the x-rays of Mr. Atkinson and determine whether or not he had any asbestos-related disease.
And who took the x-rays?
Who took the x-rays?
Yes.
I believe Mr. Atkinson was screened as part of a union screening along with his coworkers because he spent his entire career working with asbestos-related products.
So why would his treating physician not be involved if he truly had this condition? Why would he have not gone to his treating physician and said, you know, I apparently have this disease, talk to me, deal with me, treat me?
Well, Your Honor, there are multiple reasons for that, the first of which is at the stage that Mr. Atkinson's disease was in, there is no treatment. Which is why this statute is a little misleading. There is nothing to be done for him. It is a progressive disease, but at the stage he was at, there is no treatment for him to be had.
So he had a screening in a trailer? Was it a trailer? One of the trailers that was described in the briefs?
Specifically, Your Honor, I do not recall whether it was a trailer or not.
And this x-ray was sent to an out-of-town doctor, out-of-state doctor, who made this diagnosis, who never saw the gentleman, never did a differential diagnosis, never ruled out any other causes, never looked at smoking issues, never looked at anything, but made this diagnosis. Is that correct?
No, I believe he did do a differential diagnosis, Your Honor, and with respect to pleural thickening, smoking has no impact.
How could he do that by simply looking at an x-ray?
Because he's aware of Mr. Atkinson's work history, and he's a B reader, and he knows what asbestos pleural thickening looks like on an x-ray. He's trained to do that under an ILO standard. So under the law as it existed prior to House Bill 292, Mr. Atkinson had a viable non-malignant claim that could have and should have proceeded to trial. Dr. Altmaier is a competent testifying medical authority for the purposes for trial in Ohio. Whether or not Mr. Atkinson wanted to seek out a treating physician was up to him and might be an issue with respect to whether he has insurance coverage, with respect to any treatment at all.
As I understand it, Mr. Green, you submitted a diagnosis of esophageal cancer that did not mention asbestosis and a death certificate listing the cause of death as congestive heart failure, but also failed to mention asbestosis. How would those develop the requisite degree of proof to meet the prima facie requirements?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Your Honor, because I want to clarify first what's not before this court, and that is the question of whether this statute applies to Mr. Atkinson's esophageal cancer claim. I want to clarify that that was an issue in our briefs in the lower appellate court, and that court chose to deal with the constitutionality first and did not address whether this statute applies to his esophageal cancer claim.
You didn't submit those documents in support of the prima facie requirements? Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
That would be correct, Your Honor, because we don't believe that the statute requires a prima facie showing for esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer is not one of the three categories.
Oh, it does for asbestosis, though, right? For this claim.
For a non-malignant claim, it does. And Ohio recognizes...
I'm going to the fact that a cause of action for bodily injury caused by exposure to asbestosis accrues when the plaintiff is informed by competent medical authority that the injury is related to the exposure. And I don't know that you submitted any evidence at all in support of that.
We did submit...
What evidence did you submit?
We submitted the B reading for Mr. Atkinson that showed that he had an ILO rating of 0/1 demonstrating asbestos pleural thickening as a non-malignant disease process. Ohio does recognize separate causes of action for separate injuries. The non-malignant disease process caused by his exposure to asbestos, the pleural thickening of his lungs, is an entirely separate injury, an entirely separate cause of action than the esophageal cancer. Okay. There is no requirement in this statute for a prima facie showing for esophageal cancer, and with respect to his cause of death was not related to his non-malignant disease process, so we would not submit that as part of the prima facie claim.
Counsel, I want to pursue the issue about the actual claim rather than the prima facie showing, and that is what the cause of the elements of the cause of action were as, under common law and what they are under the statute. And first of all, do I understand that you are suggesting that the statute made a change in the elements of the common law to prove a claim for exposure to asbestos?
It absolutely does, Your Honor. Again, you'll see repeatedly cited in our brief that the standard for a non-malignant claim in Ohio prior to this act was the demonstration of any material change to the lining of the lungs caused by asbestos. That is what Mr. Atkinson's asbestos pleural thickening is, by definition.
And that is the common law that we used in the trial courts, and it was at least one case in the Court of Appeals that used that standard, or is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
This court has never ruled on what the common law was in an asbestos exposure case, has it?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, no. I would clarify that the change here is is dramatic. Pleural thickening, a change in the lining of the lungs, is very different from what this statute requires. This statute requires a diagnosis of asbestosis, of a fibrotic disease of the parenchyma of the lung, and a class 2 AMA impairment, and it requires a PFT. A PFT is a test by which the individual blows into a tube and his lung capacity is measured on a variety of ratings. This is why, Your Honors, Mr. Akeson's claim is permanently defeated by this statute, because his disease did not progress, although a recognized cause of action before the statute, it did not progress to that level of impairment, because he passed away before it progressed to that level of impairment, because he did not have that test done. He didn't know he had to have that test done in order to maintain his cause of action, and because he did not seek out a treating physician for this claim, because when he passed away in 2003, he didn't know he was going to have to do that to maintain this claim.
Counsel, following up on what Justice Kupp was asking, Mr. Schuster's, and I don't want to misinterpret what he said, but I had the impression that he was suggesting you didn't put in enough to even dodge summary. Although you weren't faced with summary, you were faced with a motion to toss your case based on the new statute, correct?
We were faced with a motion under this statute, Your Honor.
You're right. Okay. But did you have enough? Had you put in enough? I guess you weren't facing a motion. Did you have enough to dodge summary?
I believe we did, Your Honor. We
and you believe you have enough evidence to dodge a directed verdict if you got to trial?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
At the end of your case?
Yes.
So is it your argument then that this prima facie statute requirement under the new statute sets a higher bar than you would have had to get past summary or to dodge a motion for a directed verdict at the end of your evidence in the case in chief prior to the change in the law?
It absolutely does, Your Honor, in terms of who is required to testify and in terms of what that showing is and what the injury is supposed to be. It absolutely does. And the difference in this case versus Bogle or the other cases that have been reviewed is nothing in Mr. Akeson's situation will change, and he will never be able to meet that higher bar as opposed to that one that was in effect prior to the passage of this act.
So that's what we're arguing about, is whether or not you had a winning case for this disease. You believe you had enough, part of the change in the law, to get that into the hands of a jury?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if I may, the distinction here is that there is nothing that was clarified or redefined by this statute. This statute, vis-a-vis competent medical authority and vis-a-vis the substance of what the injury is an entirely new and higher standard that this plaintiff would have to have met, and he can never meet it now.
But you're also arguing that if the case did get to the jury, you now have different elements to prove than you would have if you don't follow the statute.
Conceivably, yes, Your Honor. If you could get by, if there was a way I could get by that higher standard of disease process and who is a competent medical authority for the purposes of a prima facie case, I don't have to show any of that at trial. I can put up any medical expert that's competent to testify under the rules of evidence, and I can put forth evidence of pleural thickening as a disease or any asbestotic disease that does not reach the impairment level as required by the statute. So I would actually have to get up over that bar, and at trial I can do something entirely different if I could get over that bar.
If you were using the common law elements as you indicate was in effect, but if you were using the statutory requirements for a cause of action, you would still have to prove what you'd have to prove in a prima facie showing, right?
Yes. I have to meet that prima facie showing prior to the common law elements that I would show at trial, but they conceivably can be different, and right now the common law requirements at trial can be different and less, and your testifying authority can be different and not meet the requirements in this statute at trial. That won't happen, conceivably, because of this higher bar, but there's no prohibition to doing that. So you certainly can have a situation where at trial you're meeting lesser common law standards and you're meeting different standards as far as a competent testifying medical authority. Thank you, Your Honors. I've noted that my time is up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Riley, you have about 3 minutes, and Mr. Schuster, you'll have 30 seconds for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, I'm Robert Riley for Owens, Illinois. In 3 minutes, I'll offer 3 quick points. The first is that this legislation is retroactive only in very narrow instances. It is expressly retroactive only where it has to be. It is only expressly retroactive where this court does not have a ruling to the contrary out there. For example, Justice Kupp, your question, this court has never said that a functionally normal person who has some x-ray that somebody says shows some change has a compensable tort injury under Ohio law. The second point, this statute cannot serve its intended purpose unless these provisions are retroactive. That is why the legislature, after extraordinary fact-finding.
Well, now, that's not a very strong argument when you're facing a constitutional question of whether or not you've affected a substantive right. We need it or else these 40,000 cases won't go away.
No, Your Honor, what I think the legislature was suggesting is, because of the public policy imperatives, procedural changes were in order. And that's what they made them, because there's a necessary sorting out process. And really, that's my third point. The statute gives the trial court the ability procedurally to sort the wheat from the chaff early in the litigation. That's what it is designed to do. That procedure may conceivably have the effect of having some claims will fail. It's always true that when lawsuits are filed, some will succeed and some will fail, and those that fail will fail at various points in the process. This court in Denicola has ruled.
Did this man not have a compensable claim?
Based on the evidence presented to the trial court, he did not. If the court will look at what was given to this trial judge, nothing, including Dr. Altmaier's filled out form, even refers to the word asbestos or asbestos-related disease. The words asbestos or asbestos-related disease appear nowhere in the medical records proffered to the trial court in this case.
Counsel,
Go ahead.
I was going to say it seems that your opposing counsel suggests that the mere finding of pleural thickening and an out-of-state expert who says, well, he was exposed to asbestos, he seems to say that that's sufficient under our common law to have the case continued. Would you comment on that?
As I understand it, it is the prerogative of this court to establish the common law of the state of Ohio. This court has never so ruled, and I would respectfully urge it not to rule for lots of very good reasons. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Riley. Mr. Schuster?
With 30 seconds, I will be brief. Number one, there was no change to the common law elements of the claim. Those common law elements require bodily injury, a showing, scientific showing, that it was caused by asbestos exposure and then damages, and those elements have not changed. The evidence submitted here was a one-page B-read that did not mention the word asbestos and only said that there were some pleural changes, did not relate it to asbestos.
The problem is we have two matters here. One is the legal issue, which is going to affect many, many cases.
Correct.
The other is this case, which you claim has some deficiencies in evidence, but I'd like to hear more of your argument on the law, because that's really what we're here about.
Certainly. The law in Ohio has always required a bodily injury. This court has never said that a mere change in the pleural area, a pleural thickening or a pleural plaque, relates to bodily injury. The criteria that were adopted by the General Assembly are the minimum requirements for a diagnosis of an asbestos-related condition. The impairment criteria are the lowest level, and the level two is the first level of impairment. Level one is normal. So they chose the lowest level to show that there is actually some injury or some impairment.
Well, Mr. Benson says that under the common law, since we haven't established a standard for prima facie case in this area, that the standard by some courts could be lower for a prima facie case than the statute requires. What do you agree with that?
Well, Your Honor, the term bodily injury is in the statute, and that was clarified by the General Assembly. And this court has indicated that the General Assembly can go back and clarify ambiguous terms that haven't been dealt with by this court. That's what was done. If you're saying that we should allow every trial judge in Ohio and every court of appeals to have a separate standard for what constitutes a bodily injury, I don't think that is what the court intends, and I don't think that is what the law in Ohio means. There was no common law definition that said a plural change is the equivalent of a bodily injury. In fact, several courts have rejected that position. We've cited you to the court In re Hawaii federal asbestos cases, which said the mere presence of asbestos fibers, pleural thickening, or pleural plaques in the lung, unaccompanied by an objectively verifiable functional impairment, is not enough to state a claim. Mm-hmm. The restatement third that is coming out specifically requires more than a mere change in the cellular level, more than a mere change in the condition of the body. It requires an impairment.
Counsel, could you help us out? I mean, what I'm struggling with here, and like the chief, I'm getting confused by the facts specific of this case, but the argument seems to be, the legal argument, that if one had a compensable condition before the law changed that was good enough to get past summary, and maybe this case couldn't have gotten anywhere before the law changed, but let's assume a compensable condition before the law changed, that with the change in the law, there's a much higher standard than the standard that existed to get past summary and to get past a directed verdict and get your case to the jury, that this prima facie bar is higher than either of those standards. So you've got to go over an artificially high mountain to get your right to a jury trial.
I respectfully disagree with my colleague's representation as to what the prima facie case requires. It doesn't require a higher standard. It requires very simple proof, the same proof that you have to have before you file a suit, and that is some basis to show that you have an asbestos-related bodily injury, and as 2305.10 has required since 1980, that it requires a competent medical authority to diagnose this. And what the General Assembly did here was to look at two terms that were ambiguous, gave them definitions so that we can have a statewide standard, and chose the minimum medical criteria that the doctors of this state, the head of pulmonology at the Ohio State University Hospitals, said these are minimum medical requirements. He would require more for a diagnosis that relates the disease to asbestos. And here, in the particular case before this court, none of that was provided. If they had provided it, then they would have passed the prima facie case, and the case would have continued through our process, and it would have gone either to summary judgment or to trial using those standards that are set out in, for example, Horton, where the plaintiff has the burden of proving each element of the claim as to each defendant. Here, they couldn't even come up with basic evidence that they had an asbestos-related injury.
But Mr. Green argues that Dr. Altmaier has provided that medical record. You're disputing that.
What Dr. Altmaier provided was a one-page sheet that had some checked boxes on it. It doesn't use the word asbestosis in it. That's what Dr. Altmaier provided.
Is that not competent medical evidence of
no,
the asbestos-related?
No, that as the legislature heard, someone can't look at an x-ray and do a diagnosis. You have to have a whole constellation of information in order to diagnose. And there is no reputable doctor in the state of Ohio who practices that would simply, from looking at one x-ray, diagnose a condition. And the legislature heard that.
Counsel, that's a diagnosis of this condition. There are doctors that can look at an x-ray and diagnose a condition.
They can look at an x-ray and they can say something is consistent, that the x-ray is consistent with. They generally, then, a radiologist involves other specialties to come up with a diagnosis. I think if you talk to radiologists, what they'll tell you is that they generally don't diagnose. They read the images, whether it's an x-ray or MRI or a CAT scan, and they say this could be consistent with whatever disease. And then they look at a constellation of other information to see whether or not it's more likely than not it's that disease.
Which is the responsibility of the treating physician, and hence
Correct.
The necessity for a treating physician. So that what you're saying is that the opinion of this doctor reading the x-ray is just one component in the entire constellation that is necessary for the actual diagnosis by a treating physician in order to then put forth competent medical evidence here. And their argument is that you've pulled the rug out from underneath us. You've changed the rules midway through the process here with regards to what is necessary to prove this medical competency and the evidence, and that would be, that's the claim to prejudice here, I believe.
I believe that is what they're arguing. I don't believe that's the case. I think the procedures were changed, and it was moved up to the early part of the case to look at this information, to review it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, that's the standard in the statute, and to give them all benefit of the doubt. But they came forward with nothing here.
And address this, if you will. They're saying, if I understand their argument, is that but for this prima facie requirement, if they were in a trial situation and they did put this doctor who reviewed the x-ray on the stand, that would be sufficient evidence to support their claim. That's my understanding of what they're saying here today.
That is what I heard, too. I respectfully disagree. I think this court decided the Valentine case not too long ago, and my bet is that, and since we get to speculate here, that if I was the opposing counsel, I would make sure that doctor never took the stand, because we would do a Daubert-type challenge, and he would not be permitted to go forward and make that diagnosis merely by reading that x-ray.
And just my last question here is, the fact that the decedent, or that the plaintiff here is a decedent's representative, and the decedent is, there is no doctor that can come forward and say, I treated him, this is my diagnosis, I used the x-ray, I did the appropriate analysis and came up with this link or this causation, that is not sufficient, because this particular individual or individuals similarly situated are shut off from proceeding to develop that type of evidence. If it's not there, it's not there.
Well, Your Honor, if what you're saying is that if somebody can't get their treating physician to say they have a disease that's related to their asbestos exposure, then what I would say is they shouldn't have filed the case to begin with under Rule 11. If your treating physician will not offer a letter or a statement or an affidavit or a deposition indicating that they believe you had this condition, then I would say you don't have a basis for bringing your claim forward. And that was the situation here. This individual did have treating physicians. They either didn't go to them and get the information, or those doctors would not say that there was a relationship between the asbestos exposure and the condition.
And then in a situation where you have no functional impairment, let's say you have an individual who has the pleural thickening, but no functional impairment at a particular time, the case would be dismissed administratively, and then if it comes to the point where the disease manifests itself into functional impairment, it can then be reinstated, as you mentioned earlier.
That's correct. Or if they have another treating physician who would say that, yes, they meet the standards, they could bring that forward at any time. The case is reinstated. The statute of limitations is told under the statute. There's no refiling fee. The legislature went as far as it could go to protect individuals in this situation from the early, from the situation where someone is saying that they're sick who doesn't have a basis for saying it and thereby causing the accrual of a cause of action that doesn't exist. And that is the situation we find here. That was the reason for the 1980 amendment and the clarification of those two terms, bodily injury and competent medical authority, was within the legislature's prerogative. I would also note that
sum up quickly.
Yeah, that there is a severability provision here that this court must take into account in reaching its decision.
Thank you, Mr. Schuster. Mr. Green, thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.